Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, digital royalties lawsuits. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another of our special episodes marking the 20th anniversary of CMU, in which we look at the biggest stories we've covered over those two decades. So far, we've spoken about EMI, HMV, The Enemy and Groove Shark.
Plugging the previous ones there, I noticed.
Yes. This time, we're going to look more broadly at lawsuits launched by pre-internet artists over digital royalties. Although I think there's one case particularly that at the centre of this, that of FBT Productions, aka Jeff and Mark Bass, the production duo. Jeff Bass worked with Eminem on quite a lot of his stuff, but they worked on some early stuff of his, which is where their lawsuit over this particularly centred. But first, why don't we just explain what the beef is?
Yeah, so these string of lawsuits all relate to the payment of digital royalties by record companies to recording artists, or obviously in the FBT case, actually, it was the producer's share of the artist royalty. So these cases all started to arrive mainly in the American courts in the mid to late 2000s as the iTunes store was starting to really take off. And so suddenly all of this download money was coming in, and it's sort of mad that already that seems quite antiquated. An olden days when iTunes and downloads were the thing we were all talking about. But this sort of basically predates the rise of streaming, and it's when download was starting to take off. And so suddenly artists on their royalty statements were starting to get not only a CD royalty declared, but also their share of the iTunes money based on how many tracks and albums have been downloaded in the previous quarter or the previous year or whatever, and what the artist was due. Now, when an artist signs to a record company, or indeed a music distributor, the record company will usually take ownership of the sound recordings that are created under that deal, or at the very least control the sound recordings that are generated under that deal. And so the way it then works is, in most cases, there are a handful of exceptions to this, but in most cases, the record company then monetizes the records. So traditionally by selling CDs, and then by the mid-2000s, by also selling downloads, the money comes into the record company's bank account, and then the record company has to share that money with the artist. And the record contract will set out what that means. Okay, so when does the label have to share the money? What share are they paying to the artist? And obviously, famously, usually on a record deal, the label gets to recoup some of its upfront costs before it pays anything over to the artist. So any cash advance it gave the artist, maybe some of its marketing costs or video costs, etc. So it can take that money back. But crucially, whenever money is generated, a certain portion is allocated to the artist, even if it's paying off a debt. And the contract will say what is shared with the artist. And usually what the artist receives differs depending on how the money was generated. So it's pretty common in record contracts that the record contract will say, okay, if we make money this way, then this is how we'll split the money. And if we make money that way, this is how we will split the money. So if we look at record contracts up until the late 1990s, so before downloading was a thing, it subsequently transpired that there were contracts more recent than that,
yeah,
even when downloading was definitely certainly incoming, which made no reference specifically to how digital income should be split. So all of these cases are relating to contracts where digital is not explicitly stated. It doesn't explicitly say when we sell a download, this is how it is split. But what classic record contracts probably say is when we sell something like a CD or before that a cassette or vinyl or whatever, this is how we're going to split the money. But if we do a licensing deal, and so that traditionally meant like a sync deal when you synchronize the music into a movie or a video game or an advert, or maybe a compilation deal where, you know, another label includes a track. If it's a licensing deal, then we'll pay a different chunk of money. And the classic thing, by the 1990s, a lot of certainly major label deals, and for that matter, plenty of indie label deals too, would say that if it was a sale, so a CD was sold, then the split would be probably in the region of 15% to the artist and 85% to the label. Some smaller labels did 50-50 splits on everything, but most major label deals and a lot of indie label deals by the 90s were 15% to the artist and 85% to the label, which might seem very unfair to the artists. Well, you have to remember that the deals in the 1960s were single-figure percent to the artists, so the artists were doing a little bit better than they had been in the early days of the record industry. But while it was often a 15% royalty or thereabouts on a sale, a license, so sync deal, compilation, etc., quite often was a 50-50 split. So the artist would be seeing significantly more on a license. And quite often, the way these contracts refer to these different things, but every contract is different. So that's why there's been a lot of debate as to whether or not things like the FBT case set a precedent that applies to every single artist contract, which we'll come on to. Every contract is different, but it was quite common to talk about sales income, 15% to the artist, and licensing income, 50% to the artist. Then iTunes comes along.
It complicates things.
And suddenly we're selling downloads. And all the artist contracts that had been signed up until that point, certainly up until the late 1990s, so Eminem's first deal with, well, ultimately with Universal Music through its Interscope division and Dr. Dre's Aftermath imprint. But the early Eminem deals were sort of mid to late 1990s, weren't they? And so those deals don't say anything about downloads, don't say anything about digital. They just talk about sales versus license. So then download money starts coming in. So the label, so in the FBT case, although all the majors have been sued on this, so it doesn't matter which major you're talking about, the record companies generally said, okay, selling a download through iTunes, that feels, from a label's perspective, quite like the digital version of a record shop. So the label said, selling a download, it's just a digital version of a CD, and, you know, we had vinyl, and then we had cassette, and then we had CD, and now we've got download. It's just a new version of the old thing. So it's definitely a sale, they said. So we'll treat it like a CD, and we'll pay the 15% royalty to artists. But you have plenty of artists, and lawyers of artists, who said, well, hang on a second, who are you to make that decision? Let's have a think about this. When you sell a CD at a shop, or a cassette at a shop, or a vinyl at a shop, that's definitely a sale. But this deal that you did with Steve Jobs at Apple, in order to allow the iTunes store to open, those deals that you did, what are those deals? They're very clearly licensing deals. You may have sneakily tried to not call them that in the actual contract, but they're clearly licensing deals. You are not directly exploiting the copyright and the sound recordings that you own. You are giving permission to somebody else to exploit, as in Apple and Apple's customers. That's a license. That's a licensing deal. So iTunes is clearly a license. And our contract says that when it's licensing income, we have a 50-50 split. And so basically you had a whole load of heritage artists and their lawyers and their managers coming forward and saying, hang on a second, who decided that we would be on the CD royalty on a download? That's a license. Stop paying us 15%. We want our 50%.
So the first big case to try to test this was launched by Cheap Trick and the Allman Brothers in 2006 when they sued Sony BMG, which was still a thing back then. And it immediately had big implications for not just that label, but all of them. Because if these two artists win a case saying we're owed the 50-50 licensing royalty on these downloads rather than the sales income that you have been paying us, then potentially you have to apply that to all of your legacy artists, which is thousands of artists.
Yeah.
And eventually a class action emerged out of this case. So then the thousands of artists were directly involved.
Yeah, so although the labels would always argue that, well, every record deal is different, the wording will be slightly different, what the artists and the managers and their lawyers are looking for was, yeah, if we can set a precedent here that says, okay, the exact wording might be different from contract to contract, but the basic principle should be iTunes is a licensing deal, licensing royalties should be paid. It's remembering that we're in the mid-2000s here when these first lawsuits are filed. So the record industry is still in freefall.
Yeah.
The record companies are still panicking. Because CD sales are slumping year on year.
And suddenly, yeah, if it has to suddenly pay out millions and millions of dollars to its legacy artists, that's definitely cause for concern.
Yeah, and at that point, iTunes was just about to explode. And so the record companies, who by this point had had 5, 6, 7 years of decline, iTunes was starting to take off. And remember, streaming was some way off at this point. And the optimists in the labels are thinking, ah, at last, something's going right. This is going to save us. Downloads are going to replace CDs. We're going to be fine. Then suddenly the idea of, oh, but hang on a second. With iTunes, we've got to pay 35% more of the money to the artists and all the back pay of what's gone before, given that even though iTunes is booming, we're still in decline. We're still making less money. Yeah, quite a lot of panicking behind the scenes at the labels that any of these landmark cases, particularly when we subsequently had class actions come out of all of this, could set some dangerous precedents, which, and, you know, whether or not they were bluffing, there were plenty of managers and lawyers who would say they were, but, you know, there were certain people at the major labels that were almost saying, if there is a precedent set and we have to go to 50-50 with all of our heritage artists on download income, this could put us out of business.
So Sony would have breathed a sigh of relief when it succeeded in fighting off that first lawsuit, having it dismissed on various technicalities. Although then in 2009, another judge overturned that initial dismissal and gave the green light for the claimants to pursue their case anew. Though eventually in 2012, they reached a settlement.
Yeah, that case rumbled on for a long time, as you say, and it was dismissed, and then it was back, and then there was sort of like, okay, what's happening with this? Oh, they're doing a deal, they're doing some settlements. And actually, quite a lot of these cases, the initial artists who pursued them often ultimately did some deals which were confidential, and we don't quite know what those deals were. Generally, with these lawsuits, it wasn't the absolute superstar artists who were suing. And quite often the FBT case was positioned as being Eminem, but it wasn't Eminem.
No.
It was the producers behind Eminem, because the superstar artists generally weren't part of these lawsuits. The assumption being that the superstar artists can walk into the record company and negotiate their own secret new deals on how the digital revenue is going to be split, because no one wants to fall out with the superstars. So they do their own secret behind the scenes deals. No one else is allowed to know about those, but the artists are the next layer down of the hierarchy. So artists who are earning off their old recordings, but they're not superstar artists. It was those artists who were trying to push this through with the aim, ultimately, to set some sort of precedent that could be applied to everybody. So yeah, that initial Sony case sort of rumbled on, and then there was a class action, and then there was a settlement. And actually, that was the first of the settlements where, even though for a time it felt like the artists really had the momentum and that the artist's argument was starting to win, the ultimate settlement wasn't that impressive for the artists.
No, so Sony set aside $7.95 million to compensate the affected artists, out of which they'd also have to pay their lawyers, so that pot is already diminished. And it spread out across quite a lot of artists. Those artists would also see their cut of digital income increased by 3%, which is quite a lot less than they were pushing for initially. But like all the majors eventually settled these big class action cases, and yeah, the artists never got out of it a 50-50 deal. I mean, certainly not, as you said, the more mid-level artists. Who knows about the big artists? The rumour was that certainly the Allman Brothers and Cheap Trick did their own separate settlements where they got much better deals that were kept secret.
But as I say, for a time, it really felt like the artists and their lawyers were winning the argument on this, despite the fact that the initial cases, we had different rulings in different courts and judges were sort of wavering one way or the other. Should we treat downloads as sales or licenses? Is every contract different? But the thing that really made it feel like the artists had the momentum was the FBT case.
Yes, and which was already up and running by the time Sony put that settlement forward. In fact, FTP had already won against Universal over their royalties and those early Eminem recordings.
Yeah, the FBT case was initially launched in 2007, so that's a year after the first case involving the Allman Brothers and Cheap Trick. Like with the Sony case, Universal won at first instance. So in 2009, a court sided with Universal, but the case continued, went on to other courts. And ultimately, on appeal, FBT won. And they said, yep, FBT are right to say that they should be getting paid a higher licensing rate on their downloads. Universal tried to take it to Supreme Court, but Supreme Court refused to hear the case, which meant that while we were still waiting for the long-running Sony case to go through the motions and for that class action to be ultimately settled, it felt like we had a nice firm precedent that had been set in the appeals courts that said quite clearly that download was a license and artists should be getting the higher royalty.
Yes, although Universal and every other major label said, no, I'm sorry. This does not set a precedent, because the wording of the FBT Productions contract is so specific to the production duo and those recordings that it doesn't translate to all the other artist deals that we're currently squabbling over.
I suppose it helped Universal to an extent that it was a deal with the producers on the Eminem recordings rather than a straightforward artist deal.
Yes.
So although,
had it actually been Eminem, it would have been very different.
Although, as we understand it, the terminology in the FBT deal was pretty similar to the terminology in a classic artist deal. But I suppose there is a slight difference there. And as you say, yeah, I mean, the majors pretty much throughout and to this day insist every deal is different. So, OK, even if in this court the judge says, by my understanding of this contract, they should be getting a higher royalty on download, that doesn't mean that we can apply it across the board. But once momentum started going on this, so we'd had the Sony dispute and the class action that came out of that, and then we had the big FBT ruling, On the back of that, there was two or three years where every couple of months, a new lawsuit was being filed. There were two or three class actions going through the motions. I mean, there was two against just Universal at one point. And so new lawsuits were being filed against all, well, four of the majors as there were at the time, three once EMI became part of Universal. And we started to tally all of them up. Obviously, where it's one artist suing, invariably those lawsuits get settled behind the scenes and we don't know what is happening. But once it's a class action, then any settlement that is reached has to go back to court, and that's usually public domain, and we know the terms of those settlements. But as I say, weirdly, despite the fact it so felt, particularly on the back of the FBT ruling, that the artists had the momentum here, as far as we can see, pretty much all, certainly the class actions that were settled, went the same way as that Sony class action, which was a chunk of money to compensate for the past, and okay, we'll pay you more on a download than we will on a CD, but a few percent more.
Yes.
Rather than going from 15 to 50%.
Yeah, so in 2013, Warner unveiled its own proposed settlement to a class action that had been brought against it, which would see royalties on pre-iTunes contracts up by 5%. And it also set aside an $11.5 million fund to provide extra payments to compensate them for past downloads. Again, like that's spread across a lot of artists. It's quite a small pot. Lawyers have to be paid out of that. So it's like they don't come out of it with that great a deal. They get a little bit more money on their download income. 2 years later, 2015, Universal also did a settlement. They'd be paid 10% more on downloads than would be paid on a CD sale, which sort of sounds good initially, but actually that means if they were on a 15% split for a CD, they'd be on a 16.5% split for a download. So they're still a long way off.
Yeah, the increase
50-50.
The increase is 10% of the 15%.
Yes. They also set aside an $11.5 million fund to be split among the eligible artists and the lawyers. So, yeah, and that's sort of it. Like, all of labels have now settled their class actions. And, well, we've got the FBT ruling, but apparently still we have no answer on this. I mean, there have been numerous other lawsuits since then where artists have attempted to test basically what precedent the FBT ruling sets, but we still don't have any answers. And in that time, streaming has become the dominant form of music consumption. Downloads have dropped massively. I mean, CDs are still a thing, but streaming is where everyone's making their money, and that complicates things even further. But maybe it doesn't. There's a clearer argument for saying that streaming income is based on a licensing deal rather than a sale. So maybe we're closer to an answer there, but I don't remember getting any answers.
No, so once we saw the shift over to streams, as is often the way of legal stuff, it takes so many years for these various lawsuits to be filed and the various settlements to be reached and then the class actions and those to be settled, that by the time this had been settled and we sort of got, kind of became industry standard. I mean, every deal is different, every royalty is different, but we started to get an industry standard whereby, okay, we pay a 15% royalty on CDs, maybe we pay 17, 18% on a download. And in some cases, that was applied to newer contracts as well, because obviously, with newer contracts, there isn't the ambiguity because a newer contract will explicitly say this is the royalty on a download. Although there have been some more recent disputes that show there were still contracts in the mid to late 2000s where there wasn't a clear, certainly streaming royalty, if not download royalty. So with newer contracts, generally there is less ambiguity. But yes, as soon as we'd started to get some sort of consensus on what the royalty was due on a download, even though very few artists were happy with the consensus, but we started to get consensus, and then it's sort of like, do you know what? Downloads are now irrelevant. Streaming is coming forward. And as you say, bearing in mind the original argument was the iTunes deal that the labels have done is clearly a licensing deal. Why aren't we getting our licensing rate? Once you shift into streaming, that's so clearly licensing. It's nothing like selling a record in a record shop. It's like, surely there's even a better argument for having a higher royalty on the streams. Most of the cases that were filed, which were mainly filed in the American courts, were very much iTunes cases. They were testing the royalty on a download. We have had a handful of more recent cases where streaming royalties were either part or in some cases the centre of these disputes. Although even there, well, with the cases where streaming was part of it, in the main, they're either still slowly working their way through the system, or we had another of those secret behind doors out-of-court settlements where we don't know what was agreed, so no precedent can be set. So we are yet to have any judicial oversight on whether or not there should be a higher royalty on legacy contracts on streams. Although what FBT has taught us was, even if we did get that, it doesn't mean we'd see a change of practice across the industry.
No, I mean, the closest we got was 19 Entertainment's lawsuit against Sony Music over the recordings released by American Idol contestants, 19 being the owner of American Idol and Sony Music being the allied label that then released the records by the winners of that competition.
Yeah, so that lawsuit was quite complicated because it had various royalty gripes.
Yeah, this wasn't the only part of it.
Also, it wasn't the artist suing the label. Yeah. It's because the artists kind of signed to 19 through American Idol and then that music gets licensed. So again, as a test case, it was a bit complicated because it wasn't a straight artist contract that was being tested. But within the dispute was the whole digital royalties on older record contracts. I mean, again, you would think that the American Idol contracts would have had all of the digital revenue streams. I know streaming didn't really take off until 5 years ago, but it was a thing in the early 2000s.
Yes.
So you'd think that these contracts would have been new enough to have all of this set out, but seemingly not. And so within the multi-layered 19 versus Sony royalties dispute was the question on, where it isn't clearly stated in contract, what royalty should be paid on downloads, but crucially also on streams.
Yeah, so in 2016, a judge refused to give a summary judgment in that case, saying that there was too much ambiguity in Sony's streaming deals. The judge overseeing the case said that 19's argument that the higher royalty should be paid on streams depended entirely on the wording of the secret agreement struck between Sony and the various streaming service, and said that Sony should hand over those secret agreements to 19 so that they can check.
Yeah, so that related to the argument that had been given way back in the early days of these disputes on downloads, which was, are these licensing agreements? They clearly are.
Yes.
But the argument being, no, there's wording. These agreements clearly in the agreements themselves refer to themselves as distribution agreements. So this is a distribution deal, so therefore we're going to classify that as sale. And, well, I mean, we never got resolution on this in court.
It was settled.
It seems to me that that is, well, there is precedent elsewhere that just because a contract self-describes itself as being one thing doesn't mean it is necessarily that thing if it's clearly something else. So I think there would have been an argument to say, even if the Sony contract with Spotify, etc., clearly stated in its first term, this is not a licensing agreement, it is a distribution agreement. I think there still would have been an argument of saying, that's nonsense, it's clearly a licensing agreement. But yeah, a settlement came. For a while, there was quite a bit of, you know, stern talking on both sides in this dispute. So was it going to get to court? No. So there was a legal settlement, so we never had resolution on any of that.
Now, there have been further cases on this matter in recent years. There's been like the Carpenters, Quincy Jones, the Elvis estate. But the FBT case remains the only one to come close to offering some clarity on the sales v license debate, but then not enough to actually put the whole thing to bed. So, I mean, in terms of the 2 decades of CMU, this story alone has taken up more than a decade, and we haven't finished. We haven't got anywhere with it.
The most recent case to be filed on this topic that certainly grabbed the headlines was Enrique Iglesias. So that is, as far as we're aware, still working its way through the motions, and that included streaming in there as well. But yes, the only case that really properly got into court and set a precedent was the FBT case, and then that precedence seemed to apply across the industry. It's hard to know, I suppose, with hindsight, had that ruling not been there, would the labels have tried to resist having any increase in those class actions? Or indeed, were those class actions, because, I mean, the Universal ones came after the FBT ruling.
Yeah.
So maybe the uplift from 15 to 16, 17, in some cases 18%, even though that's nothing like the 50% those heritage artists who sued originally wanted, I suppose it was a few percent more. And it might be that that wouldn't have happened across the board had it not been for the ruling in the FBT case. But yeah, I mean, certainly it was not shifting things up to 50-50. It's interesting, beyond the interpretation of ambiguous old legacy artist contracts, there has been the discussion around, shouldn't artists be receiving more in the digital age from downloads and certainly streams, on the basis simply that surely a record company's costs are lower in the digital space versus the physical space. One of the reasons why labels used to justify taking so much of the money when recordings were monetized was that they had to press up and distribute all those CDs, which was very costly and very expensive. And so lots of artists and managers and lawyers of those people say, costs have come down, surely we should see a higher return. Labels respond by saying, okay, yes, our physical production costs have come down, we no longer have to manufacture CDs, but our marketing costs have gone up. So you may believe that, you may not believe that, but that is often the argument put forward. labels will say we're still a primary risk taker, still a very risky business. Yes, record industry's back into growth, but it's nowhere near where it was in the 1990s.
I mean, Beggars Group did at one point start paying out 50-50 on its streaming income with artists. And then eventually said, actually, we can't afford to do that. We're going to have to stop.
Yeah, they voluntarily did that when streaming first came along. They said, we're going to do a 50-50 split on this, and then slowly reduced it and reduced it again by saying, because streaming had become the primary revenue stream, actually, the economics of the label, it didn't work to do that. So they do pay a higher royalty than certainly the average major label contract will. But, I mean, nothing like the 50-50 that they were doing for a time. So beyond the interpreting legacy contracts, sales versus license, which is what most of these court cases we've been referring to ultimately focus on, there is the whole debate about how the money should get split, the digital pie debate, as we call it. It may well be that actually the outcome of this has nothing to do with interpreting old contracts. I think with the rise of the distributors and the label services companies, which offer much more preferential deals than a traditional label, they don't bring as much to the table. So that's why they can afford to offer the artists more. But those deals are available for those artists and management teams who feel that they can make those deals work. Of course, recently we've had word of Spotify reaching out to artists and saying, well, why don't you license us your music directly, cut out the label and distributor, and then you'll make more money. Again, that only works for a certain sort of artists with a certain sort of management. But because there are more options on the table now for artists when they're picking labels and distributors, it may be that as a result of that, we do naturally start to see artists getting higher royalties, even with pretty classic record deals from pretty traditional record companies. But in terms of heritage artists trying to get their 50% on downloads and streams based on ambiguous old contracts, well, behind the scenes, who knows how many superstar artists manage to get something like that, but when it comes across the board as industry standard, nowhere near.
That's it for this special edition of Setlist. Follow us on all the social media. Setlist Pod is our name. You can email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU, presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.